From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. The brilliant biographer Donald Spoto returns to the show this week. It's always a pleasure to have him here, but it's especially nice because in our last conversation, after the publication of his fine book about the Redgraves, Donald Spoto said he was going to retire. Happily, he found at least one more important story to tell. His new book, which I believe is his 29th, is the life story of one of the cinema's great talents. The book is A Girl's Got to Breathe, The Life of Teresa Wright. Donald Spoto, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary. I'm delighted to be with you.
You've written so many great books, and you've written about many great men and women, but I think you're particularly adept at great actresses. You've written about Grace Kelly, Joan Crawford, Marilyn Monroe, and now you've turned your talent to the life of Teresa Wright, and she's such a great actress, such a fine actress, but I don't think she's as well remembered today as some of the women that you've written about, some of her own contemporaries. She made some bad decisions in her life?
I would say that Hollywood made the bad decisions.
Yeah.
She did not. You're quite right that she is not as widely remembered as some of her contemporaries, like Betty Davis, Joan Crawford, you know, some of those great luminaries, if you will, of the 40s. But among the dozens and dozens of people that I met and spoke with about working with Teresa, she was certainly the most loved, the most admired. Her talent was extraordinary. She made only 27 feature films, but she really preferred the theater. She had a number of plays on Broadway, as you know. Her television credits are over 100 titles. It was an extraordinary career that lasted over 50 years, over 60 years, actually. When she died at the age of 86, almost 11 years ago, her credits in my forthcoming book, in my present book, go on for 6 pages single-spaced. So I think it was a question of Hollywood, you know, especially in the past, but as now too, tends to pigeonhole, to categorize actresses. Oh, she's this, he's that. We can't let them out of their presumed, niche. Teresa was, from the start, seen as the ingenue, the winsome all-American girl. Now, that was part of her range, but it certainly did not exhaust her range. As you know, the fourth picture she made, Shadow of a Doubt, she's, for Hitchcock, she's anything but a winsome all-American girl. She's a girl whose introduction to the evil in the world leads her to be capable of murder and to will murder. And in other films following that, she had an extraordinary range. And she often told me that she wished she had not been so often categorized. She wanted, for example, to do much more comedy. She had an extraordinary gift for comedy. So, but what she did gives us a legacy that is really, really remarkable.
Well, let's start with Shadow of Doubt. Since you, Donald Spoto, are so closely associated with Hitchcock, and you've written extensively about his work, and Hitchcock often stated that Shadow of Doubt was his personal favorite. And the film, which is a classic by any standard, rests almost entirely on the young star, Teresa Wright. And it's, you know, we hear the term coming-of-age story so many times, but in this case, she is one person at the beginning of this picture and a completely different person at the end of the picture. And in a way, you know, she represents, to me, when I see the picture, in a way she's like the world, or America in particular, because that movie was made during World War II, and World War II certainly opened our eyes to the horrors of what people could do to each other. And that's what happens to her in that picture.
Well, you put it very well, Gary. And the fact is that it's made more extraordinary as a performance by two facts, I think. Number one, she was 23 years old when she made this picture for Hitchcock. Number two, it was, like all motion pictures, or almost all motion pictures, filmed out of continuity. So later scenes were filmed at the beginning, and the earlier scenes were filmed toward the end of production. As you know, they had to film various scenes when the sets were available, when the co-stars were available. The task of the unit production manager, as the job is called, was very, very difficult. So you're right. What you have is a coming-of-age picture in which a girl moves from being a winsome, innocent girl with a sweet view of the world to being a young woman with a much transformed view of a world that is shot through with possibilities for malevolence and evil, even within herself. She learns this because her beloved uncle turns out to be a sociopathic serial killer. But the fact is that performance of hers was, I always discussed it with her under the rubric of, what a difficult role, what a difficult role. And she said, well, of course, I never thought of it that way, because that would have killed any spontaneity for me, she said. And I remember when I talked about her performance with Hitchcock himself, he lit up and he said to me, oh yes, I got along very, very well with Teresa, which of course was not a fact that characterized his relations with all his actors or actresses, but he was very fond of her and she of him. And this is as good a point as any to share with our listeners the fact that, I say this with immense gratitude and pride, that Teresa Wright was one of my closest friends for over 30 years. She was the first person I ever interviewed in my career, and it was for my first book, The Art of Alfred Hitchcock, still in print, and I wanted to talk to her about making Shadow of a Doubt. And that day, I guess it was sort of clear to both of us that something clicked and we became friends. And from that day, June 26, 1974,
wow,
until her death in March of 2005, we were just very, very close friends. I was with her through good times and challenging times, and she with me. And it was a cherished friendship. And, of course, that gave me an opportunity to discuss so much about her life and career. When she left us, her family invited me to deliver a eulogy at her memorial service, and then a couple of years ago, they invited me to be her authorized biographer. Well, what a blessing!
Did they, when you say authorized, did that mean that they had any say in editing your book, or?
Not at all. Not at all. They asked for nothing. I did want them to read the finished manuscript before we went into production for, you know, suppose there was some ridiculous error of fact that somehow was there, or something that jogged their memory, something important that they had forgotten to tell me in interviews or that I had omitted. So I was delighted to let them read it, and they made some wonderful comments, but they never asked for anything to be changed. They never asked for approval. It was a blissful project from first day to last, and for that I must thank primarily Teresa's daughter and son. It was, and I gained their friendship as a bonus.
We're talking with Donald Spoto, and his new book is a biography of Teresa Wright. It's called A Girl's Got to Breathe, The Life of Teresa Wright. I think, you know, her film roles are the most accessible of the things she's done, because, of course, now you can find lots of things of her television work, you know, on DVD or even on YouTube. But the films are the ones, I guess, that are most likely to be in circulation. And, of course, there are three films, I guess, that are most likely. And the one that we've mentioned is Shadow of Doubt. But her Academy Award-winning role in Mrs. Miniver, and with Gary Cooper as Mrs. Lou Gehrig in Pride of the Yankees.
Yes, these are very well known. I think a lot of film film fans also know her brilliant performance in her first picture, The Little Foxes, with Bette Davis, for which she was nominated for that first picture for... she was nominated for Best Supporting Actress. This is an extraordinary beginning of a career. For Teresa's first three pictures, she received four nominations for The Little Foxes, for Mrs. Miniver, for which she won the Oscar, and, excuse me, and for Pride of the Yankees, she was nominated that year for Best Actress. I mean, it was a brilliant beginning. I mean, it was a meteoric rise, as the cliche goes. I think people also remember The Best Years of Our Lives.
Oh, of course, people, yes.
Which is an extraordinary picture. But I would like to also call attention to a couple of films which are available, excuse me, on DVD, which are, I don't know why they're ignored, Gary, but they are. There's a 1949 picture, Enchantment, in which she played with David Niven as her co-star. And it's a wonderful picture based on a wonderful novel by Rumor Godden, and she just breaks your heart in that film. It's easy to get hold of. She, of course, was also chosen to be Marlon Brando's first leading lady in The Men in 1950. I think, you know, people would also very much enjoy her performance in The Actress with Spencer Tracy and Gene Simmons. And let's not forget, as well, The Good Mother, Diane Keaton, and her last performance for Francis Ford Coppola in The Rainmaker, in which she is both poignant and terribly funny. So it's a career that spanned 50 years and such a range. I mean, she really, I can say this about a few other actors and actresses, yes, but she never made a false move. And that's not the loyalty of a friend speaking. The fact of the matter is that when you sit down and watch her pictures, you never get to a scene or to the end of the film and say, yes, but there's this point at which she doesn't seem to quite know what's going on, or she doesn't quite, never. And Teresa was the most modest and down to earth. I would sit with her over these many years and say, Teresa, in this picture, thus and such, you are so wonderful and natural, especially in it. And you, she said, well, you know, I had a wonderful director. And that's it.
Well, she is a very naturalistic actor. And you mentioned The Men with Marlon Brando, which I happen to love that picture. I guess maybe she didn't love it, but I did. And I think there's a scene in that picture where she, when she forces herself into the room with her husband, or her fiancé at that point, who is a paraplegic due to a wound in the Korean War. And he doesn't want to see her ever again and tells her to go away, but she won't listen. And then he cries like a baby, and she just touches his hair. It's the most tender and most beautiful and most... It's so realistic. And Brando, of course, was famously a method actor. What about Teresa Wright? Was she a method actress? What kind of an actress was she?
No, Gary, and I'm glad you asked the question. She wasn't a method actress. She never understood what that was. And I think the fact that she wasn't is responsible for these undilutedly wonderful performances. It was she told me almost in the same words when I put the question to Ingrid Bergman. Ingrid became a friend of mine through Teresa, in fact. But the fact is that I would say to them, how do you do this? Do you have a school or a method? How do you do this? And Teresa said virtually the same thing that Ingrid said. Well, I read the script and I think, well, gee, that's a good role. That would be an interesting role to do, and I can trust that director, so I'll do that. And then he did it. They did it. They memorized the lines, and they went to rehearsal, and they went on the set, and they did it without any self-conscious, you know, oh, how does this relate to my life? What can I tell people about how this, you know, is similar and analogous to something in my past? They never thought of themselves that way. They just thought, golly, this is an interesting character. I would like to present this character, you know?
Well, Donald Spoto, did she have some kind of technique as an actress that she could rely on when you have to do a take over and over again to continuously stay naturalistic?
No, she just did it. And if the director needed a retake for some reason, she did it again and tried to do it as close to the original take as possible. Having spoken to a number of her directors, happily, primary among them Hitchcock and Fred Zinnemann, for whom she acted in The Men, as you know, and I admired Fred Zinnemann immensely. Teresa and I went together to the premiere of what turned out to be his last picture, 5 Days, One Summer. But they said she was just so easy to work with. If you asked her to do something again, oh, yes, okay, I'll do it again. Ingrid was the same way. They enjoyed their work, and they never thought of themselves as important. They thought they were fortunate to have a job that they loved. And, this also relates to something that should be emphasized. Even during Teresa's busiest years, which were the 40s, she was an immensely attentive mother. She was a good wife and a wonderful mother. And that can't be said of all actors or actresses.
No, you've written about Joan Crawford, who I guess famously was not such a wonderful mother.
Well, yes, but I feel it's essential in the case of Crawford to almost ride to her rescue. In my biography of Joan Crawford, in that book, Possessed, I demonstrate, I think, to the point of proving it, that most of the stories about her cruelty to her children were made up by her daughter, Christina. The other three children said about Christina's book that they didn't know who she was talking about. Now, I don't think Crawford was a loving and present mother all the time, but she was. I simply demonstrate that a great deal of Christina's book is a fantasy, because she was told she'd make a lot of money from this, which she did. The same thing happened with the daughter of Betty Davis.
Right, so, Betty Davis. When Christina Crawford's book came out, Betty Davis said, "Oh, isn't that a shame? Isn't that horrible?"
Yeah.
And then the same thing happened to her.
Exactly. And Gary Merrill, from whom Betty Davis was divorced at the time after a quite acrimonious separation, Gary Merrill called a press conference and said, "Listen, Betty and I had an unhappy finale to our marriage, but I am coming to her defense. She was a wonderful mother. She never abused her daughter, B.D. Hyman, as her name was, and she refused to work during the summer because she felt she wanted to be completely attentive to her children and to me, and we always went to Maine every summer for 3 months, and this notion that she was a cruel mother is a lot, to use the famous words of Ben Heck, I'm using now, a lot of ooey. But then you have people on the other side, like Teresa, who were attentive, and Teresa had offers to do European films, to travel abroad for stage and screen, and she said, when the children were young, she said, "No, I won't, because my children are in school, and I'm here for them." And, I mean, there you have it. It's the fact of the matter. But I can't... Something I'll also say just once, because this kind of thing doesn't need to be repeated. She was an extraordinary friend. I'll tell you what kind of a friend she was. She would pick up the phone and call for no other reason than to say hi and how are you and let's get caught up. What's been going on? It was not for an agenda or a specific purpose. Now, I've always said that's one of the unfailing signs of real friendship, is when someone telephones you just because they love you and they want to hear your voice. And that's the kind of friend Teresa was. In addition to that, she and her second husband, the playwright Robert Anderson, to whom I also became very, very close, were the kinds of people who would say, "Oh, Donald, you should meet so-and-so. You'd enjoy them, and they're wonderful people, and you should get together. We'll arrange supper," or something like that. And that's how I met Ingrid Bergman and Dorothy McGuire, and, you know, I'm not going to drop names, but it's a long list of people who became friends of mine thanks to my friendship with Teresa and Bob.
I love it when you drop names, Donald Spoto. We're speaking with Donald Spoto, and this book is called A Girl's Got to Breathe, The Life of Teresa Wright. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. You mentioned that Teresa Wright was nominated for an Oscar for her first film, The Little Foxes, and that's kind of unusual to come to Hollywood in a major featured role. She didn't have to... she didn't have to play bit parts. She wasn't in the chorus. So she sort of refused to do those kinds of photos, right? She wouldn't do cheesecake photos or things like that.
You're exactly right. You put it perfectly. That's a great summary, actually. But I think it's important for our listeners to remember that when Goldwyn brought Teresa to Hollywood for The Little Foxes, she had been a major Broadway star in Life with Father. She had been in Life with Father for 2 years. In the role of the ingenue, Mary, and Broadway fell in love with her, the country fell in love with her, and she's only, at the time when Life with Father premiered, Teresa was 20, and she was brought to Hollywood at the age of 21, and for The Little Foxes, and everybody said, oh my God, you're going to play opposite Betty Davis, oh, you better be careful, oh, she'll eat you alive, this is terrifying. Well, Teresa just said, I've got this wonderful role, and William Wyler is the director, and I'll do my best. Well, Betty Davis was crazy about Teresa. She recognized the talent. Betty Davis was a very generous actress, by the way, throughout her career. When she saw people that maybe the director was ignoring them and not giving them enough close-ups, she'd go to them and say, look, this is a scene that's important. It's going to be important for their career. I think you need to build her up a little more. Crawford was the same way with Anne Blythe in Mildred Pierce. Anne Blythe says this every chance she gets to this day, that Crawford would go to Michael Curtiz and say, you really have to pay a little more attention to Anne in these scenes and lengthen her close-ups a bit. This is going to be very important for her career. These things need to be said. As you know, Gary, we do not live in good-spirited times. We live in mean-spirited times. And I think when we can say something true and good and honorable about someone, we should say it. We should celebrate it. And in the case of Teresa, when she went to do The Little Foxes for the great William Wyler, opposite Betty Davis and Herbert Marshall, you know, and this wonderful cast with several major players fresh from the Broadway production of The Little Foxes, Teresa just thrilled them all. And, of course, she made two more pictures with William Wyler, for one of which she got her Oscar, and that was Mrs. Miniver, and then, of course, again, for The Best Years of Our Lives. And, alas, William Wyler died before I had a chance to talk to him, but I did spend some time with his widow, Tally. And Tally said to me, oh, Willie was mad about Teresa. He would have done 10 pictures with her. And at the time, Wyler said, on the record, excuse me, we have the sources for this, he said, she was the finest original youthful talent I ever worked with. I never thought that this girl they were sending me at this young age, with no film experience, would take to the camera so well and would be so malleable and such a team player. Everybody fell in love with her. And I, as you know, I interviewed dozens of people for this book. I knew dozens more who had worked with Teresa. And when you mentioned Teresa's name, people just smiled.
Well, I want to ask you about some aspect of her, which is her voice. She had a remarkable, beautiful speaking voice, and something about that voice conveyed, I don't know exactly, maybe a sort of a melancholy, not that she was crying, but it would just pull a tear from you, and I think maybe that's how she won her Oscar in Mrs. Miniver, or the way that she affects you in The Best Years of Our Lives. It's a very interesting speaking voice.
Yes, it is, and people don't often talk about that in relation to acting. Teresa's voice was like a musical instrument. She could play it over several octaves. She could play it for sentiment. She could play it for irony. She could play it for fear. She could play it for love. And the range was immensely impressive. This might be the time to mention something which we won't go into because it's really complicated, but our listeners, if they get hold of the book, I think will be fascinated by it. There was nothing in Teresa's childhood or upbringing that could have prepared for such a splendid talent developing. She had, as you know, a childhood and an adolescent of eye-opening unhappiness and terror, and simply awful, awful things happened to her, which we won't go into now. But it makes all the more remarkable not only that the talent blossomed, but in addition to that, that she herself became this wonderful wife and mother and friend and colleague. Her life is almost miraculous.
Well, it is interesting because I think a lot of people sort of tend to play the tapes they recorded when they were children. That is, the life, the way their parents were, they often are with their own children. But you would say she was the opposite.
Yes. Yes. And that it's an old saying, but it's a true one. If a person isn't given love early on, they're very often incapable of it later. That's not true in Teresa's case. And I think our readers will be astonished by the facts of her early life and respect and love her all the more. But to get back to the range that we were talking about with her voice,
mm-hmm.
She, for example, could do the ingenue in Life with Father and The Little Foxes, but then she could do The Dark at the Top of the Stairs, William Inge's play on Broadway. A sort of frightening mother figure. She did, well, Arthur Miller and George C. Scott, when the revival of Death of a Salesman was being prepared, I went to that opening night with Teresa, on Broadway. George Scott said he wouldn't do it unless Teresa was his Linda Loman in Death of a Salesman. And Arthur Miller said she was brilliant, the best ever. And then she did comedy, of course. She did Eugene O'Neill, Our Wilderness, and Mornings at Seven, which was perhaps her biggest Broadway hit of 2 years on Broadway. So it's and in all of those, as you said a few moments ago, that voice carried her through the distinctive dialogue that she was required to deliver.
And, of course, she was a great beauty.
Oh, well. Those blue-green eyes, that pellucid skin, like alabaster. When I first met her, she was, June of 1974. She was 50, not quite 56. And to the day she died, at 86, the skin remained this flawless. A scalpel never touched her face. She was just beautiful, and she never thought of herself as beautiful. She always said, "Oh, if only I could do something about this nose." I would say, "Teresa, what's wrong with your nose? Did any director of photography or makeup artist ever say there's something wrong with your nose?" "No, but they don't look carefully." But it spared her that kind of star complex. I'll tell you an interesting moment I had with Teresa. In 1978, we were invited to dinner with some colleagues of mine. I was teaching at the time in New York. Teresa was frequently a guest in my classes on film, talk about pictures she had made. And I asked her once at dinner, "Teresa, how is it that so many stars, and I've met a number of them, have this terrible star complex about themselves? It's like me, you know, or it begins to sound like a Brazilian song. I. And you've never been that way. Never." And she looked at me and absolutely truthfully her wide eyes, and she said, well, you know, I maybe it's because I was never really a big star. Now, that, of course, is nonsense. She was Goldwyn's biggest star actress throughout the 1940s. But she never thought of herself as a big star. Hmm. And the list of friends who were famous, I mean, Ingrid Bergman loved her and took her into her confidence. I could spend them today just listing the great directors and actors who loved working with her.
I was talking with film historian Janine Basinger about Pride of the Yankees recently, and she wrote a book about marriage in the movies, and I said that I thought Pride of the Yankees is more a marriage movie than it is a sports movie, because it's really the relationship of Lou Gehrig and his wife.
Right.
And so tell us a little bit about her relationship with Gary Cooper. How did that film go and so forth?
Well, the making of the film was fine. As you know, she made more than one picture with Gary Cooper, but Pride of the Yankees was the first. And as she said to me, well, I was required to kiss him, of course, in the picture, but I never really knew him.
Hmm.
He was an admirable actor, much underrated at the time. She said, when you were on the set with him, you never thought there was anything extraordinary going on. But then when you saw the finished film, you saw, good heavens, there's a lot going on here. But they got along very well. But Gary Cooper was one of the sources, one of the three reasons why I chose my title, A Girl's Got to Breathe. There was a kissing scene in Pride of the Yankees, and Gary Cooper sort of prolonged the kiss. And Sam Wood, the director, didn't say cut. And finally, Teresa broke the kiss and said, a girl's got to breathe. And the whole crew broke up. So it was such a great moment that Gary Cooper said to Sam Wood, let's do it again. I want that line in the picture. And it is in the picture. They did it one more time. The kiss was shorter, which it had to be by Hollywood rules at the time.
Yeah.
And when the kiss was broken, she said, that girl's got to breathe, you know. There are two other reasons, which the reader will discover, why I chose my title, A Girl's Got to Breathe. But one of them has to do with the fact that her survival as a child was in doubt for a while. She was very sick. But anyway, Gary Cooper, she got along with him, but as she said, she never really knew him. When there were breaks, or when he wasn't needed, he would go off to the side and whittle a stick or, you know, play a crossword puzzle or something. He didn't sort of fraternize with the crew and cast. She didn't have expectations that people would do that. The great thing about Teresa was she didn't have expectations of people. She took them for what they were, actors or not. And so they got along. Actually, nobody I ever spoke to didn't get along with her. But I saw directors and actors at a lot of parties that I went to with Teresa, and they would see across a room that she was there, and they would light up and run across the room and hug her. And, you know, I said, wow, she's really much loved and admired. All the good reasons for that.
And Donald Spoto, you wrote a book about Alfred Hitchcock and the relationship he had with all of his women, and some of those were pretty unseemly relationships. What about his relationship with Teresa Wright? She held her own with Hitchcock? She
wasn't
that intimidated?
It was terrific. It was respectful. It was when they were filming Shadow of a Doubt, most of which was done in the summer and early fall of 1942. The film was released in January of 43. Teresa had just been married to the writer Niven Bush, her first husband, in May, actually, of 42. So that when they started to film, she had literally cut her honeymoon short because the filming schedule required her to be back in Hollywood. So what happened was that Hitchcock, and he did this to a lot of actors, actresses, he would, just before a take, he would whisper, and this I have from Teresa herself, and it's a recorded in one of our interviews, he would say something terribly obscene to her, usually having to do with a bride on her honeymoon. And I said, well, how did you cope with that? And she said, well, I looked at him as if I didn't understand what he was talking about. Or I acted as if I just didn't hear it, which is a brilliant way of, you know. But he admired her very much, and they did get on brilliantly well. She was a director's ideal performer, you know.
Well, she wouldn't be baited by him.
No, absolutely not. And she was working with Joseph Cotten, with whom she worked again 2, 3, 4 times later on film and television. And they were great friends. I'll never forget a dinner I went to, and I talk about this in the book, dinner I went to around 1989, 1990 in Hollywood. It was one of the thousands of award dinners, you know. And Teresa invited me to be her guest, her escort at the dinner. And there was a table of 10. And at the table were Teresa and I, Joseph Cotten and his wife, Patricia Medina, the great Wendy Hiller with her Los Angeles agent. She had come over from London. And next to me on my right was Alida Valli with her son, and Robert Mitchum and his wife, Dorothy. And something happened at that dinner, which I can't repeat on the radio, but readers will have fun reading about it. And it involves Bob Mitchum, who did, you know, 2 pictures with Teresa. They got on famously, too, although sometimes he frightened her a little bit. He could be powerful. I mean, he was a fine, fine actor, but he could be powerful in a scene to the point of intimidation, not intending to hurt or you know, intimidate his acting partner, but it was a little much sometimes. But it was a memorable dinner. I mean, imagine, here was I, you know, in the very early stages of my career, surrounded by the A-list of old Hollywood. It was a memorable evening.
You must have been starstruck, face it.
I was, and I'm not ashamed to admit it, because then I learned from all these people. Another time, this was many years later, Bob and Teresa, Robert Anderson, her second husband, Bob and Teresa invited me to join them at a party that the great Lucille Lortel, she was the owner and founder of the Théâtre de Lys in Greenwich Village, and a great producer, stage and screen, and she had a full-floor apartment at the Sherry Netherland Hotel in New York. And Bob and Teresa asked Lucille if they could bring me as another guest, and Lucille said, of course, and I went along. Well, the people at this party, I spent almost the whole evening with a lady named Stella Adler. You can imagine how much I learned in those hours. And every time I would say, well, Stella, I must let you go. I'm sure you wanted to. She would just grab my arm and pull me back on the sofa. She said, now, let me tell you about this. And that was just, you know, there was the history of theater in one lady's life, you know. And she was great. And Al Hirschfeld, you know, the great caricaturist and artist, was there with his wife, Dolly Haas, who also had a role for Hitchcock in I Confess. And it was a wonderful, wonderful evening.
Well, I always love talking to you, Donald Spoto, and your new book is called A Girl's Got to Breathe, The Life of Teresa Wright. And I think anybody that loves film will love this book. And I hope that not only will they read the book and love it, but also go back and see some of the work of this great actress. Donald Spoto, thank you so much for joining us here on From the Bookshelf to talk about it.
As always, it's my pleasure entirely, Gary.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll come back and see us again next week. I want to thank my guest, Donald Spoto. His latest book, A Girl's Got to Breathe, The Life of Teresa Wright. I hope you will visit our podcast page, fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.